City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.
This is Talk to Trisha on City Talk 105.9.
Colm O'Gorman is the director of Amnesty International in Ireland. He's also a former senator and the founder of his own charity. But whatever achievements he adds to that impressive CV, he'll always be remembered as the man who sued the Catholic Church and won. As a boy, Colm was repeatedly abused by his parish priest, and like many children in that situation, he was just too scared to tell anyone. As an adult, he found the strength to speak out, and in 1998, he began a lawsuit which ultimately resulted in an admission of negligence and the payment of damages by the church. Later, Colm successfully campaigned for the first Irish state inquiry into clerical sexual abuse and founded the organisation One in Four, which works with survivors of abuse. Well, he's just published an autobiography called Beyond Belief and joins us now. Colm, welcome to City Talk.
Thank you very much, Tricia.
Can we start from the very beginning? What was your childhood like?
Yeah, it's difficult to answer that question because I kind of had two childhoods. I had a fantastically idyllic childhood, growing up on a farm in rural Southeast Ireland, surrounded by nature and life and death and all of that in its most fabulous, normal, natural forms. And that was wonderful. I was one of six children. It was a very rich, in a natural sense, kind of life, and a very joyful and free kind of life in lots and lots of ways. Yeah. But then on the other side of that, there was a darkness because there were also some men who lived in the small village that I lived in who were abusing children, and I was one of the children they abused.
And how old were you when that abuse?
I was five, around about five the first time that happened. And to be frank, I don't know how long that carried on for because I was so very young at the time. My memories of it are strong but shady. They're the memories of a five-year-old as opposed to the memories of an adult.
And did you tell anybody?
Gosh, no. I mean, I had no way of understanding what it was that was happening to me. This was 1971. Mm. And, you know, I lived in an Ireland where sex didn't exist, never mind the sexual abuse of children, and where people didn't talk about such things. I lived at a time when the messages I got from adults around me were that, you know, to be good and everything would be okay, that you should do whatever an adult told you to do, that you never challenged the authority of the word of an adult, that all adults were good, and that they only hurt you when you were bad. So when some adults who I knew and who were men who lived in the area, respected men who lived in the area, really, really hurt me, then for me at five, that meant that I must have been really, really bad. I didn't have the words to understand what had happened, even if I could have spoken out. Yes. But I certainly didn't feel able to know.
When did Father Fortune come into your life?
Much later on. I was when I was 11, we left the farm and I moved to a small town, Wexford, in the southeast of Ireland. Went to school there, started to really rebuild, I suppose, my life and my sense of myself. I was a very outgoing child in lots of ways, very interested in people and very, very eager to engage in the world and quite idealistic. I got involved in lots of church-based activities because I went to a church school. All of the schools in Ireland were at the time. Involved in a folk group in my church, involved in a youth group that was attached to church. So church was everywhere. Church was a normal part of life. Yes. And it was at an event, a youth club event, that a young priest in his late 20s suddenly appeared, you know, from behind some curtains on a stage I was sitting on and started to talk to me, which was nothing at all exceptional. It was normal. And 2 weeks later, he arrived at my family home one evening, and because he wore a collar, because he was a priest, that was his key to the door. Yes. He was invited in and sat down in the best room in front of the fire with tea and chat and conversation, and that's how I met him for the first time.
So do you think that because you'd been abused before, once he started abusing you, did that reinforce that you were bad or what?
Absolutely. I mean, in my professional life, I've been a psychotherapist, and the organisation I founded, actually, which I founded in the UK, I lived in London for 17 years, called One in Four. It's still based there in Southeast London. I worked as a therapist with the organisation, and in the most common impact, particularly of early child sexual abuse, is re-victimisation. Yeah. Once the boundaries of a child have been so completely swept to one side, once a child has been taught that this is what's possible and that there's no salvation, no rescue, no way of being saved from this, then re-victimisation is almost inevitable. Unless some kind of support is given. So I think the two things are completely connected, yes.
Do you think by that stage your boundaries had been taken away? You wouldn't have known what was right, what was wrong, what was safe, what was unsafe?
I think what I had learned is that when terrible things happen that you can't say out loud because your society won't let you say it, because they're unthinkable, unspeakable things, and because you're frightened that you'll be seen as the evil one, then you simply split. You live in two worlds. One, the world in which the abuse happens, and that's a dark place that you only inhabit in the moment that it's happening, and you leave it as soon as it's over because you can't cope with it. And the other, where everything is normal and healthy and good, and the way that the people around you demand it should be. When children don't speak, it's not because they don't want to speak. It's because all around them they're told they must not and that they cannot. Children do what they're told.
Now, what about God? How did God come into the equation?
Well,
Where was God?
Well, I mean, at the time I had a very two-dimensional image of God. God was wearing a collar standing in front of me, and that was what was so confusing, because at that point God was an authority that was made manifest, that was made real, made physical, by religious, by people like Father Sean Fortune. So God was on his side, and that just made it much clearer that I was the bad, foul, wrong, evil one.
Did you turn that in on yourself?
I despise myself. I mean, I became... Because the first time that he abused me, I remember running from the room thinking... not knowing what to think. I mean, when I say it was insane, I don't mean that in a glib or cliched kind of sense. I felt insane because the world in that moment was insane. Because here was this man who was a priest. Here was this man who represented God. And he had just done these things. And I had just, as I saw it at that time, done those things with him. This wasn't how the world could be. If this was possible, nothing about the world made sense. So I couldn't live in a world that didn't make any sense. I literally would have lost my mind. So I had to find a way to make sense of it. And to do that, he had to be good, because he couldn't be bad. Nobody would believe me if he was bad. And that meant I had to be the bad one. So there was a comfort in the moment. There was a way of surviving and finding sanity by blaming myself, by becoming the bad one. So I became the abuse.
When you looked in the mirror, what did you see?
It depends on what moment. When I looked in the mirror in the world where I could acknowledge what was happening, I saw something foul. I saw something sick and shameful and foul, and that was me. I became the abuse. There was no way of naming that badness. There was no way of making that real, so I became it, and I despised myself.
And how old were you then?
I was from 14, almost 15, until I was 17 and a half. Until I was 17 and a half. So I became at times very heavy. I put on lots of weight thinking, and that was shame really. I was just covering everything up in fat, in layers of shame, hoping that that would repulse him, but also feeling repulsed by that myself. So I was repulsive. It didn't work, unfortunately. So all of the anger, all of the rage, all of the bitterness, all of the hurt and the despair got turned inwards, and I became very depressed, very down, and an awful lot of self-loathing. I lost all respect for myself.
Did your parents not notice?
I hid it as well as I possibly could. There were moments when I tried to tell. There was one particular moment, and I detail it in the book, where he arrived not long after it all started. He used to come to my house and take me away for the weekend because he lived, his parish was about half an hour away from where I lived in a car. So he'd come and take me away, and about the second time he came to take me, I didn't want to go, and I was up in my bedroom saying I didn't want to go. And he was down at the bottom of the stairs, and my mother was running up and down the stairs between the two of us, not understanding why I was saying I didn't want to go with this priest, who, because he was a priest, must be good and must be right, and him telling her that, yeah, well, clearly he's just made some other arrangements, and that's not good, and he should have to honour his obligations. And I started to cry and couldn't tell her, and she's up and down the stairs and up and down the stairs, and eventually I'm told that I have to go with him. And in that moment when I got into the car and he looked at me and he had won, that's the moment when I absolutely gave up and I surrendered to what I saw then as my fate. I surrendered to having to put up with and tolerate whatever it is that he chose to do with me. He defeated me completely.
Did you ever try to say to him, stop, I can't deal with it, or anything like that?
Yes, there was one particular evening, one particular night, when he started to touch me, and I just couldn't take it, and I said no, and he kept doing it, and I said no, and he kept doing it, and then I shouted and screamed at him no, and I got up and I went out of the room, and I went to bed in another room and started to go to sleep, and I listened terrified, thinking he would come after me, thinking that's it, he's going to come now, he's not going to allow me to say no, that's not allowed, I'm not allowed to get angry, but he didn't, and I fell asleep. And then I woke up later on, and indeed he had come after me. He didn't say a word. He didn't say anything. He pinned me down. He raped me. He left without a word. He told me in that behavior that what I wanted didn't matter. He was bigger. He was stronger. He had the power. He had the authority. I was the bad one. Nobody would believe me, and he could do whatever he liked.
Oh. How did you end up on the streets, Cole?
I fled my hometown, Wexford, in January of 1984. At that point, my depression had become so significant and my despair that I needed to leave. And it was either leave that town and run and try and find a place where I could begin to work out who I was, or leave the planet, you know, go in the river. And I didn't want to go in the river. So I left. So I hitched to Dublin with a suitcase. And started to try to rebuild my life. But those first 9 months in Dublin were tough. I mean, I was homeless for nine of those months and very, very vulnerable. I was a small-town boy in, it's a small city in relative terms, but in to me, what was a very big city and a very lonely city, and I had no idea how I would cope because there was no help for somebody of that age at that time in Dublin.
Were your parents wondering what the hell you were about?
My mother and father's marriage had been slowly disintegrating over a long period of time, and there's no doubt that that's part of the vulnerability that existed. You know, they're just, I was one of six children, and they were, and I don't mean this in any critical sense, because we all struggle with what we're struggling with. They were struggling with their own pain and hurt, I suppose.
Yes.
And my mother had left and gone to India, of all places, with my three younger siblings a few months before I left home. So she was gone. And my dad was in a very difficult place as well, and I just left and ran, and I didn't go back for nearly 4 years.
It was kind of the disintegration of the whole family.
Yeah, everything. And in different ways, the family was disintegrating as well, and I was disintegrating in isolation from that disintegration because of the abuse and because all of those struggles. So no, nobody came looking for me. I saw one of my sisters once. Briefly, and had the courage to tell her about some of what had happened with Sean Fortune. But then I was so ashamed of the fact that I told her that I ran again and broke off contact and just hid for almost 4 years.
I'm talking to Colm O'Gorman. This is City Talk 105.9, The Voice of Liverpool. Colm, can I don't know how else to ask this, so I'll just say the words. Which came first? Were you gay before the abuse, do you think? I'm going to ask a question which a lot of people would ask. Did the abuse, do you think, contribute to you becoming gay? Where does that fit in?
I think it's a great question, and it's a really obvious question that lots of people are too polite or too anxious or too frightened to ask, so I'm really glad that you did, Tricia. I think that, you know, I mean, where I am in all of this is that I believe that sexual orientation is not something that's developed through experience. I think that it's inherently part of who we are. I think that I was a sensitive infant. I was a sensitive child. I mean, that was part of why I had a very detached relationship from my father, who didn't know how to relate to that sensitivity. I think that was there in me. And I think that's what contributed to that vulnerability in me. And I think that that's part of what was targeted by those men. The impact of that was meant that I didn't relate to or understand or have an uncluttered, unviolated experience of sexuality in a way that allowed me to understand it at all. I mean, sex and sexuality of any kind to me was something that was that was violent, that was exploitive, that was dirty, that was wrong, that was furtive. There was nothing healthy or positive or pleasant about sex or sexuality at all. So it took a very long time for me, once I'd fled Wexford, had a very difficult time on the streets where I again experienced a lot of exploitation because I was so desperate and so vulnerable that I allowed myself to be exploited just to find a bed to sleep in for the night. So it was a very long time before I began to connect with or understand my sexuality. I found myself on the gay scene in Dublin because I thought that might be a place where I belonged, and actually I found out that it was. And that was the beginning of me trying to find a way to explore and understand my sexuality in a way, frankly, that most people do in their teens.
Yeah. When they begin how old were you by that stage then?
I was 18 when I first went onto the scene in Dublin and joined a youth group there and began to just question things a little bit or in, you know, just experience things in a very, very different way. But, you know, I think what's interesting is that very often when people ask that question, I'm always fascinated as a therapist when I worked with people who themselves experienced sexual violence as children. Mm. I've never met anybody, regardless of their orientation, be they heterosexual or gay, who didn't question their orientation because of that experience. Yes. And the reality is that sexual abuse, the rape of a child, is such a violation of the sexual person that, of course, it causes enormous disturbance when, as an adult, you try to find out who you are and how you can express that aspect of yourself, regardless of your orientation. But what fascinates me is that so often people try to explain if a child has been abused, let's say a boy has been abused and he turns out to be gay, then a link is made between the abuse and the and the homosexuality. I can understand it because it seems kind of obvious. But at the same time, if a girl is abused and she turns out to be lesbian, people often make the same link. And I kind of wonder, well, hang on, so you're thinking that because of a boy who was abused, he got turned on to it. But whereas if a girl, she was abused, she got turned off it. It's not terribly consistent.
It's a very, very good point.
So I don't think that the two things are related. I know for me they're certainly not. I think for me the struggle was, and it was really only really in my thirties, from the age of about 33, 34, when I found myself in a really loving, life-affirming relationship with my partner, that I began to really break free of all of that and understand my sexuality as something life-loving and affirming and positive and healthy.
But so there must have been a difficulty, Colm. Homosexuality in Ireland. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it wasn't a good time. I mean, when I first came out on the scene in Dublin, homosexuality was illegal in Ireland. This was in mid to late 84, and it was only in 1993 and I was living in London at that stage that law, which actually was an old Victorian law, a hangover from when Ireland was under British rule, that was only repealed in 1993, and that was repealed in pretty dramatic fashion. And actually, the lawyer who represented a former colleague of mine in the Irish Senate, David Norris, who took the Irish government to the European Court of Human Rights, was a woman called Mary Robinson, who went on to become President of Ireland and UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. So it changed very radically when it changed, but you're quite right. Being gay in Ireland wasn't an easy thing to be, and being gay in rural, small-town Ireland was an impossible thing to be because it was invisible. There was nothing. I mean, it seems ridiculous to say it now, given the world that we live in, but there wasn't a single... I'm not even going to say it was a positive image. There was no upfront even image, negative or otherwise, of homosexuality or of gay people at all.
It's still
difficult. It just didn't exist.
It's still difficult, isn't it? Because I've come across quite a public figure in Ireland who still is leading a heavily closeted life. Because if he was out, it would destroy him.
Well, I mean, I'm not known at all in the UK, of course, but I'm a public figure in Ireland. I've been a senator. I've sat in the Irish Parliament. I've tested elections. I've made films. I've done an awful lot of stuff over the years. Yeah. And I've always been out. I made that decision when I was returning to Ireland with my partner Paul that if I was going to come back here, I needed not to live a life that wasn't very upfront and very clear. Not anything that was, you know, I'm not flagrant. I'm not remotely interested, actually, in the fact that I'm gay. It's just incidental. It's just it's as insignificant to me as being heterosexual is to anybody else. But I wanted to make sure that nobody else was going to make something of it. And we live in a small town. We're very involved in our local community. We have two children that we're guardian to who go to our local school. We actually set up the local school. I must say, I haven't found it hugely difficult, and I haven't found people being unkind or unsupportive or disrespectful. Maybe they are being, but they're not telling me, and frankly, I don't care. As long as I don't have to meet it, my family don't have to meet it, we don't really care.
But maybe that's because you did take the stand you did against the Catholic Church, and there would have been many, many, many voices who didn't have the strength, who didn't have the courage to do what you did, who were secretly sort of, as it were, cheering from the sidelines. What made you decide to speak out about what happened to you?
It was about 1994, and I had finally really stopped running, or at least at least to a large degree started to stop running, and started to reflect back on my life. I mean, I say in the book that up until quite recently, my life was like a series of books that I'd read, you know, disconnected from each other, that I just moved on very quickly and put difficult things behind me and didn't think about them. But when I found myself in a place in my late 20s where I was getting older a little bit, where I was more settled, where it was time to pull this life back together again, that meant reflecting back a little bit. And as I allowed that to happen, my first concern was, he could be doing this, whatever this is, to somebody else.
Yes.
This man could still be hurting children or young boys. I can't not do something about that. So my initial thought was, I need to say something to somebody because this could still be happening. I didn't fully acknowledge what it was this was, and I certainly didn't allow myself to connect with the reality of what had been done to me, because that would have been too overwhelming at the time. But I was really, really concerned about what might have been happening to other people. So I began to talk to my sisters, about it, and friends and others.
Had they never guessed?
It had been a kind of an open, hidden truth in my family. I told one of my sisters when I was 18 in that very brief reunion before I ran away again, and she had told my father. So everybody knew about it, but when I came back at 21, we never, ever spoke about it. It was one of those awful, awful secrets that nobody could deal with, so it was never spoken about.
There must have been a lot of guilt for the whole family.
Yeah, and just fear. I mean, nobody knew how to begin to name it. Nobody knew how to do anything with this horrible, horrible fact that there was nowhere to place it. And nobody wanted to deal with it, so nobody did.
Did your mother ever deal with it?
Did my mother ever deal with it? Again, it was never spoken about. If we spoke about it at all, it was after I decided to come forward, and she would talk about her horror at what had happened. But that was about it. I mean, one of the interesting things, and again, this is in the book too, was when I did come back at the age of 21, I never asked them why they didn't look for me.
You didn't?
No.
Did you ever wonder? Or did you think that you weren't looking for?
I didn't want to put them in a position at that point, you know, at 21 years of age still, and really up until my 30s. My relationships with other people, including my family, were about making sure that I didn't offend them, because I needed them to like me, because I didn't like myself. So I needed to be loved so that I could believe somehow I was worth liking or loving in some form. And that meant that I had to find out what they wanted and give it to them, because I couldn't possibly be loved for who I was, because I was bad. I was a bad person. So I would never say anything that would have offended them or upset them. I would never give them anything that would give them a sense of how I felt about myself or the world. I didn't relate to the world for myself. I related to the world based on what I believed other people wanted from me. I mean, that was the abuse dynamic. You know, make it all okay, get away from it, don't create a problem, don't create any trouble, and everything will be fine. But cause trouble and things are going to go horribly wrong. So I never asked, no, ever, ever.
I'm talking to Colm O'Gorman, Director of Amnesty International in Ireland, former senator and founder of his own charity called One in Four, working with survivors of abuse. We're talking about Colm's autobiography called Beyond Belief. And we're going to take a quick break. And coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to hear more about, I guess it's a very disturbing story, but as Colm himself admits, an uplifting one as well. We'll see you the other side of the break.
This is Talk to Tricia on City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back. This is Talk to Tricia on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool, and I'm with Colm O'Gorman. Father Fortune ended up committing suicide before he could be brought to justice. How did that make you feel?
As I said, in 1994, I knew that I needed to do something about it, and I came forward. And father, who's very, very significant in this book, this isn't a book that's just about abuse. It's a book that's about relationships and about fathers and about sons and about loving and about standing up and speaking out and the liberation that can come from that. It's a very hopeful, optimistic, uplifting kind of book, I believe. My father was instrumental in me coming forward because in 1994, New Year's Eve 1994, he broke down, acknowledged what he'd known for 12 years, that this had happened to me because my sister had told him, and said he couldn't live with it anymore. And that was the final thing that for me brought me forward. It was now
seeing somebody else's grief.
Well, having him name it, having him name that this had happened, yes, and hearing that he couldn't deal with it, and hearing his grief and upset in it.
Did it make it a reality?
Yeah, it made it very, very real. But I guess also I had always been terrified of him finding out. I mean, Fortune had used the threat of telling my father what was wrong with me. You know, in those moments when he was being the priest outside of the abuse, after the first time he abused me and we were going home again, and I thought I would never have to see him again, on the way back in the car, a few minutes before we got to my house, he turned to me and he said, "Colm, you have a problem. And I'm a priest. And I have a responsibility to help you."
Did he say that problem was?
No, he didn't have to. I knew what the problem was. I was dirty. I was what had happened the night before. We both knew what he meant. And he was a priest, so he had to be right. I was 14. What did I know? And also, I already believed this. And he said, "So I can either tell your father," at which point I felt an explosion go off inside me. I thought I was going to die because I couldn't live if my father knew what I was and what I'd done and how sick and bad I was. And then he said, "Or you can come back to my house again and I will help you." And I knew that that meant you can come back to my house again. I mean, I was naive, I was stupid, I was terrified, I was lost. But I knew what that meant. I knew that that meant he would keep abusing me. But I knew that my father finding out was more terrifying than that. So when, all those years later, my father broke down, 20 years later, my father broke down and named this, named his hurt, that was a kind of a liberation, to be honest, because it made it real. So I spoke to him immediately, and I arranged to come back to Ireland. And I was, as I said, I was living in London. I came back to Ireland in February of 1995, and I made my complaint to the Irish police. And at that time, I thought that it was just me making a complaint against Sean Fortune, that I was the only one he had done this to. But within months, the police had found six men who told the same story. And he was facing 66 charges of serious sexual assault, buggery, gross indecency, and other offences. It took 4 years for it to get to court because he dragged it out and out, and he dragged it just out and out and out through the court system.
Do you think he thought he'd get away with it?
I think he believed that because he'd gotten away with it for so long, because as we found out in years later, the church had known that he abused boys before they ordained him. Again, this is in the book Beyond Belief, but all the way through his career as a priest, they received complaint after complaint after complaint about abusive behavior, about allegations of child sexual abuse, of him bullying people. And they simply allowed him to continue as a priest, apart from one short period where they sent him to London for a while. That's a good old pattern, you know, that Irish bishops often send priests to the UK when they needed to take them out for a while. And then he was brought back and put into another parish and continued on.
But when he killed himself, were you angry?
I was devastated. This was in 1999. It was 4 years after I made my complaint. Almost, you know, 1 month, 4 years and 1 month after I made my complaint, it became clear to him that he was going to prison. He tried to drag the case out when it came to trial again and found himself remanded to the Central Mental Hospital, which is essentially a secure psychiatric hospital for a psychiatric assessment. He thought if he played that card, he'd be out on bail, but he wasn't. He was committed. In the end, he didn't go to the hospital. He was held in Mountjoy Prison because when a psychiatrist examined him at the prison, it was found out that there wasn't a problem. So he spent a week in prison, and I think that focused his mind. So he applied for bail, came out of prison, and committed suicide. I was at home in Wexford, in my sister's home, waiting to go back to London after, you know, thinking, here we go, it's going to be years more before this gets to trial. And I got a call from a journalist to tell me that he'd been found dead. He'd taken an overdose of drugs and alcohol, of sleeping medication and alcohol. And I can just remember breaking down and sobbing and not really understanding why, because what really confused me was I wasn't just crying for me or for the other boys or for my father, who had died 10 months after we found each other. Yes. And again, that's a big, big part of the book. But I found that I was also crying for him, and that really confused me.
You were crying for Father Fortune?
Yeah.
Why?
Because no life should be that. No life should just... I had hoped, and it was perhaps a naive hope, but I don't believe so. I think it was a hope based on a belief that as human beings, if we're prepared to face the truth, we can deal with anything.
Did you think if he said sorry?
No, I don't know that I wanted him to say sorry to me. I think what I wanted him to do was face the truth of what he had done, because I genuinely believe that it's only in facing the truth of ourselves that we can move on and rebuild a life and do whatever we need to do to put things as right as we can possibly put them. Him saying sorry to me wasn't something I was hung up on. I wanted him to look at himself and find a way, if that was at all possible, to forgive himself. I wanted to be free of him and free of the guilt and free of the blame and free of the shame. And I wanted him to take whatever he needed to take and go and deal with it.
But when he killed himself,
sure, of course he didn't. Of course, because he didn't want to face that in himself. He was too pathological, too terrified, too bad, too whatever. He didn't want to face that in himself. He didn't want to be brought down to have to face that in himself. So he chose to kill himself instead. Now, that was his choice. Yeah. But for me in that moment, part of the grief that I felt was in a way, even a grief for the child that he once was. Because I genuinely believe that all people, by nature of their being human, have value and have merit. That
doesn't you didn't want to go out there and kill him yourself?
Oh, God, yeah, I want to do that too. You know, I mean, all of those things. That's what I mean by I was so confused by that response.
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
You know, at the same time as I hated him and had finally gotten to a point in my life where I was able to access that anger and that hate to a degree that I fantasized about finding him in a room and tearing chunks of flesh from his bones and throwing them at the wall, at the same time as all of that was true, I also at moments had to face the truth of his own humanity. There was a book written about him by an Irish journalist, and funnily enough, I live in the town where he was from, so I drive down the street every day. But and it told a story where, as a child, as a boy, somebody found Sean Fortune in a doorway dark at night of a shop, and they couldn't understand what was wrong, and he was upset, and he was worried, and he was crying, and they said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "Well, I was told to come into town to buy a bag of sugar, but the shop is closed, and I'm frightened to go home without the sugar." And that made him human to me in a way that was incredibly challenging.
Yes.
Because that made him more than the monster that he became. That made him a frightened boy, a frightened child.
Monster that was created.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think that in truth, whilst he is absolutely responsible, and this is in some mad, you know, woolly, liberal, you know, off-the-wall, politically correct thinking on my part, even though I maybe am all of those things as well, I genuinely believe that we create monsters. They don't.
Yeah.
They're not born. We create them. And had Sean Fortune ever had the limits put around him that society should have put around them, had when he first abused Boy Scouts whilst he was training to be a priest, had the Catholic Church said, "This is not okay behavior. We're reporting this to the police. You're going for treatment. You will face this. This is not acceptable behavior." That would have put a limit on. Had at any point when those complaints were made, that would have put a limit on. And when no limits are put on, when somebody is as dysfunctional and frankly as pathological and as disturbed as he was, it just becomes more and more obscene. So yes, he's responsible for his actions, absolutely. And I wanted him held to account for his actions, but it didn't start or end with him. It actually, I think, starts and ends with the rest of us, that we construct the society that we live in. We set up the systems that manage the way that we live together. We're responsible for each other. And when we pretend that things that are happening in front of us aren't happening, we're the problem. And the thing about Fortune was, in the parish he lived in, people knew what he was doing. People knew and joked about the fact that... When I went back, I made a film with the BBC in 2001 called Suing the Pope, because at that point, my civil suit that I was taking involved the Pope. I was suing the local bishop and the Pope. We went back to make the film, and we were in a house one night, and I asked a woman, did you know what he was doing? And she said, God, yeah, everybody knew. They used to joke, don't bend down in front of him in the churchyard. You know, people knew. And people saw him trail a succession of teenage boys around that parish and around that town. The church knew, and they did nothing. People knew. But they chose not to know because they were too disturbed at the idea that a priest could do this, too challenged. Yes. You know, if we're going to name this, that means rebuilding everything that we hold to be true. That means reconstructing and challenging the church. And people weren't ready to do this. They didn't want to do this. So they took the comfortable, ignorant option and pretended they didn't know.
It didn't happen.
But they knew.
Okay, let me just remind our listeners, I'm talking to Colm O'Gorman, the founder of One in Four, a charity which works with the survivors of abuse. Now, you mentioned before in your work with One in Four, you became a psychotherapist. Part of that training is to go for therapy yourself, as I know. Wasn't that terrifying?
You know, that was my frustration, really, because like many people who decide to get out and help others, it can often be informed, frankly, by our need to feel like we're powerful enough to help others because we don't believe that we are. And I was very lucky to find myself training with a husband and wife team in London who saw that in me and who made it very clear to me that the only way I was ever going to qualify with them as a therapist was if I dealt with my own stuff and did my own therapy and confronted my own demons, and that there was no way they would allow me to work with anybody else until I did that. And I'd gone into therapy, but I did it in a very cliched way. I went into therapy thinking, you know, I'm going here because I'm fine and I just need somebody to tell me that I'm fine. So I found a therapist who would tell me that I was fine. And lo and behold, after 6 weeks, she told me I was fine.
You were fine,
so I'd done it, you know, and I did that. That's how I wanted it to be. So then I decided, okay, now the next thing for me to do so that I know I'm really fine is I'll become the one who fixes other people. Because if I'm the fixer, that means I'm not broken. But I was horribly broken, but I just didn't want to face it. So in a strange way, that dynamic forced me to look at my own brokenness. Because I found myself in this awful dilemma where I knew that the only way I could believe that I wasn't broken was to become a therapist.
When you said you were broken, how did that brokenness show? Was it a lack of, not being able to have relationships? Because you said you were able to have a relationship. Lack of connecting? What?
Yeah, I was in a relationship. I'd been in a relationship with somebody at that point for about 7 years, and it was... I don't want to be unfair to him because he's a tremendous man and a lovely human being. But it was quite a codependent relationship. Right. We were both running from an awful lot of things. And it wasn't a relationship that was about moving on and living life and becoming all that one can be. It was a relationship about not having to deal with stuff.
Right.
When I say it wasn't a healthy relationship, it wasn't that there was anything bad about either of us. It just wasn't where we needed to be. It was a relationship where we hid. But also, I was still in that place where I lived from the neck up. Everything I did was from the neck up and the face out. I didn't go into feelings. I didn't know who I was or how I felt. I was desperately insecure. I wouldn't go into a bar on my own. Funnily enough, drinking, I went the other way with drinking. If I started to get drunk at all, I'd become really alarmed and quite worried. As soon as I felt a numbness around my mouth at all, if I'd had a couple of drinks, I'd know, and I was terrified of being unconscious, of losing control, being in charge. So terrified of all of that. So I lived in a very disconnected way, disconnected from myself, and that meant that actually most of my relationships were bogus. They were based on other people, not on anything real. I mean, I was a terribly frustrating person to have a friendship or relationship
because
I couldn't relate to myself.
Completely.
tell me what you want me to be. I remember once my younger sister, 2 years younger than me, my older sister had told me that they were having a conversation, and Deirdre had said, Colm's a really nice guy, but I just wish he would be himself. And that brought from me this cry of anguish, and I just said, what does that mean? For God's sake, just tell me what you want me to be, and I'll be it. Just tell me. Because I had no idea who I was. So, you know, having to face all of that meant having to face that past. And the reason I didn't know who I was because I was terrified of looking back, looking beneath the neck, looking into my feelings, looking into my body, and finding out that I was what I knew, as I thought, I was, which was what had been done to me, that I was foul and perverted and hideous and disgusting and bad.
But there's also the other side, isn't there? If you've had someone, or inverted commas, allowed someone to control what you do, where you go, how you feel, your relationships, don't you stop believing anything about yourself is real? Do you stop trusting yourself?
Oh, I absolutely didn't trust myself. I mean, I didn't know myself, so how could I trust myself? I mean, it was that disconnected. I had no idea of who I was or where I was. As I said, it was all, the best way I can describe it is just that phrase again. I lived from the neck up and the face out. I felt nothing and nothing was about me. It was all about other people. Now, that doesn't mean I was some selfless, you know, altruistic hero. It just meant that I was terrified of being real and because I was terrified of what people would see.
But did you never feel suicidal?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in my teens particularly, in my late teens and before I left Wexford and then at points in Dublin in the early years, yes. But I also, somewhere in me, and I think my salvation and I think what kept me on the planet was somewhere in me, all the way through this, and I think it's inherently part of who I am. Mm. I believe in life. I believe in the goodness of life. I believe in the potential, the extraordinary potential of what it means to be human and to be alive. And I believe in the resilience of that. And that's not just a belief. I've come to understand that that's the fibre of who I am.
Where did you get that from?
It's just who I am. You know, I have green eyes, and that's who I am. You know, I can't explain it. It's inherent. I actually think if we're given half the chance to connect with it, it's inherent in all of us. I think that we become cynical and jaded and suspicious and hateful and distrustful, because that's what the world tells us we must be by the things that we experience. But if we're lucky, if we're able to connect with some other truth of what it means to be human, I think that we all have the capacity to be wonderfully ordinarily extraordinary. Because I think that's the truth of who we are. And that somewhere out there in some, for want of a better phrase, other or higher part of myself, somehow never lost faith with life and kept me going. And I met the right people. I was very lucky. At key points, I met people who, with just a look or a kind word, at the most desperate points in my life, saw me. And that allowed me to stay on the planet. And, you know, a word, a simple word, a communication, a connection. You know, when I was on the streets and desperate and prostituting myself for somewhere to sleep, you know, a man who picked me up one night, who saw how desperate I was, helped me to find a job. That helped. And the guy who I got my first job with when I was completely homeless saw that and offered me a bed to sleep in. Now, I thought that meant that he wanted to have sex with me. Of course, he didn't. He was married and he had a wife, and they were just good people. Those moments of goodness. Or somebody who just said something kind to me in the street in a moment, who gave me a look, who saw me. That kept me alive because, you know, we live through our engagements with others, through our engagement with life. And if we become so marginalized and so pushed to one side, we become invisible. And that's when it gets dangerous.
Absolutely. I'm talking to Colm O'Gorman. Colm, if you could go back to when you were a little boy and you could say something to that little boy when he was feeling at his most anguished, what would you say? What advice would you give him?
I'd say be bold. Be bold. In Ireland, we don't tell children that they're naughty. So we don't say to somebody, don't be naughty. We say, don't be bold, which I think is so completely tragic, because I think every child should be bold. Every child should be outspoken. Every child should stand up and look outward and be who they are in the world. I would tell him that he is a person in his right, and that his dignity matters, and that his body is his, and that nobody has a right to make him feel uncomfortable. And that if he feels uncomfortable with a person, it's not because he's bad and it's not because he's wrong. It's because he feels uncomfortable, and he should listen to that. And if he does feel uncomfortable, he should tell someone.
Yes.
You know, that's it. And the messages we need to give our children, I think, are very simple. We don't need to tell children about sex in order to keep them safe from predators. We need to tell our children those things, that their physical integrity matters. And we need to then make that very real for them, so that when your child says to you, and they're going, you know, you're family visiting, mm-hmm. and they're about to go off to bed, and you say, go over and kiss Uncle John goodnight.
And they,
you know,
don't want
Tom
to,
says,
that's okay.
I don't want to. We don't say, don't be so stupid, go and kiss him goodnight.
No,
why
I agree.
Why would you do that?
I absolutely agree. Do you know, in Australia, that's the way they teach, my children were brought up. My body is my own, and if I don't feel comfortable with something, I have the right to say no, and people must listen to me.
Yeah. I think that's where we're getting more and more, and it's so valuable, it's so healthy, it's so progressive, and it's something to be really celebrated. But it's also true in those fun moments. You know, if you're playing with a child and you're tickling them and they go, stop.
Then, exactly.
Don't tickle them and keep going and saying, oh, don't be silly. If a child says something that relates to their physical selves, unless it's dangerous, unless they're doing something that's dangerous or going to cause them a real problem, we need to listen to that. It's not a big deal. We don't have to win all the time. We don't have to dominate them. We don't have to teach them that they have no right to control what happens to them physically. Because if we do that, then people who want to exploit that will exploit that.
Now, Colm, your actions have changed the way people in Ireland and around the world view the Catholic Church. I mean, many thousands of people have been inspired to speak out about their own abuse. But there's a way to go in changing attitudes, aren't there, within some of the more conservative factions of the church. So are you still involved in campaigning?
Well, I now work for Amnesty International, and, you know, in that role, I constantly find myself in situations where we're speaking up and speaking out and naming difficult truths and inviting people to recognize that the terrible things that happen in the world don't happen, you know, somewhere out there in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. They happen because we tolerate them. Yeah. And that if we want to change those things, we have to stand up and speak out and demand that they change. Nothing in the world ever changed because a politician said it should. Nothing in the world ever changed because that came from the top level. Change comes from the grassroots. It comes from people. It comes from people standing up and speaking out. I mean, when you look at what's happening in the UK politically at the moment, do you think politicians would be talking about reforming their expenses if people weren't screaming about their expenses? Of course they wouldn't be.
No.
That's not normal. So change comes when we speak out. So, you know, when we see terrible things, whether it be a child being abused in the way that I was, or a teenager being hung in Iran, or children being brutalized and people being tortured in China, or Guantanamo Bay, or wherever else, unless we're prepared to stand up and speak out and recognize that in truth, we're all human, we're all connected, we have some responsibilities to each other, based on the fact that we have the power to influence the world around us, that's where the responsibility comes from. Until we do that, nothing will change. So yes, I continue to push for and speak out to try to make change happen where it should happen. And I do it in my own way with Amnesty and my own way in my own life. And I hope other people will do the same thing. So, you know, the key part is name truth when you see it. Don't stay silent in the presence of wrong. Name it. If, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen? You might get it wrong. So name it with compassion, with respect. Mm-hmm. Say, I'm not sure that this is okay. I feel outraged and angry at what I see happening in front of me. I'm open to finding out that my assessment or interpretation of what I'm looking at is not wrong, but I need to name it. We need to have a conversation about this. We shouldn't be frightened of facing the things that make us uncomfortable.
That's at a community level as well, isn't it? I often say we see these little acts of wrongness, if you like, in our own communities. We see, you know, the baby peas of the world don't happen in a vacuum.
Nope.
So I think that's a very powerful message. So, Colm, thank you so, so much for talking to us this evening. It has been truly enlightening. What's next?
Well, what's next this evening is getting home, frankly. but beyond that, no, I'll be the book is out now. It's in the shops now, even though it's officially published on Thursday. I'm going to be in the UK all of next week talking to people about the book, trying to get people to pick it up and read it because, you know, it's one thing to put these ideas out there. And I didn't write this book just so I could tell a really uncomfortable or difficult or distressing story. I told it because I think within it there's a lot of ideas about how we can change these things and how we can be agents for change and a real force for change and really, really powerful. Those are the kind of ideas that I'm interested in. That's what I'm going to keep doing and that's what I'm going to keep talking about. And I hope that your listeners will recognize the capacity that they have to make Absolutely. Real change happen where it's needed and get on with it and live. We should never fear looking at things that make us uncomfortable. We should never fear looking at difficult things, because I genuinely, I don't just believe this, I know this, because this has been my life's experience.
You've lived it.
If we face the things that frighten us most, we will find our way through them. If we don't face them, they will become worse and worse, and darker, and more and more terrifying. There's nothing that we can't do if we choose to do it. It's time to stand up.
Colm, thank you so much. So I want to give people details about the book. The book's called Beyond Belief by Colm O'Gorman. It's published by Hodder and Stoughton. And there's also, let me just tell you, there's a helpline for 1in4, www.1in4.org.uk, which is a charity working with survivors of abuse. So you may have heard things in Colm's interview that have sort of touched somewhere in your heart, maybe an experience you've had or someone in your family. So if you want to have more information, 1in4 UK is a charity which provides that support and gives resources to people who've experienced sexual abuse and sexual violence. Again, it's www.1in4.org.uk, and there's also a helpline which is open on Mondays between 5 and 8 p.m. Monday to Friday from 5 to 8 p.m. I should say, and on Saturdays from 2 until 5. Here's the number, grab a pen. It's 0208 697 2112. That's 0208 697 2112. And again, the book Beyond Belief by Colm O'Gorman, and speaking to him tonight has just been incredible. I hope you agree with that too.
Listen and log on to the Voice of Liverpool, City Talk 105.9.